Good evening. This is Execution Watch. This is a program that we do at KPFT HD2 and on the World Wide Web whenever there's an execution in Texas, and unfortunately that's too often. We have one tonight, Christopher Coleman. We'll be talking about what he did and all that, and we'll also be talking with Gloria Rubach, is at the scene. My name is Otis McClay. I am not Ray Hill. Ray Hill is on assignment this week. That's what we say when people don't show up. We say they're on assignment. And I'm here with Jim Skelton. Say hello.
Hello.
Why don't I hear you? Is that thing working?
I guess it
yeah,
is.
Yeah. All right. This is a very strange thing, actually, to be doing. This is not the kind of thing that the general media deal with. And in fact, it seems like we do our best to avoid it and pretend that it's not happening. I think it's important to know that it is happening. And, I guess I would be in favor of public executions in the square. And that might be the quickest thing we could do to end this insanity of legal murder. So now you know where we're coming from. What's the story with Gloria?
Gloria is on the line.
Oh, she's on the line?
Yes, she is.
And she's on, and it's there, and I can... I don't know how to do this. I hope I can do it.
Speaker?
Gloria. Tonight, it's Christopher Coleman. That's the night, it's Kenneth Mosley. Next week, Mr. Ballantyne.
What are we...
Executions continue.
What are we saying, Gloria?
Oh, hey, Otis. Is this Otis?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so, the media just went across the street, and I'm expecting, I don't know who's witnessing for Chris Coleman. Nobody's walked across yet. But...
Has the media have gone in?
It's getting ready to happen.
But the media have gone in, right?
Yeah. I saw Michael Grachik with the Associated Press, and I'm not sure who all was with him.
Mike Grachik, who's been there for...
Grachik, is that how you say it?
Well, he says Grachik, actually.
Oh, okay.
And he's been the AP in Huntsville for as long as I can remember.
Yep, long time. I guess he's witnessed more executions than anybody.
Yeah, and, I don't know, maybe there's a book.
I wonder what...
But it sounds very quiet.
Well, it was pretty noisy till you called. I was on the bullhorn. There's a small group of people here. There's about six of us. And I actually just got off the phone with people in Austin. There's probably a half a dozen at the state capitol also protesting. But you know, the thing that really just pisses me off, that not only about this execution, where there's still unanswered questions, but there should be so many questions in the eyes of the so-called leaders of this state when, after this article in the New Yorker and the report by Mr. Baylor or Byler on the arson in the Todd Willingham case, it's like, can't they hold up for a minute and let's see what's going on here? But that doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, we're going to talk about that with Jim, because, from an outsider's point of view, somebody who's not in the legal business, for me, it's like, well, if you're going to kill somebody, you should be really sure.
Well, in this case, number one, and within our case, number two, there are no expert witnesses. So what happened to Todd Willingham has no relevance here.
No, not to this case, but the idea is, under Rehnquist, the idea was to speed it up, and I know Willingham made the point that he only had 45 days to file a writ, where somebody for a non-capital crime had 180.
No doubt. Yeah. This was brought up by Coleman in his federal writ, not Willingham.
Yeah. No, I'm saying by Coleman.
Right.
And that's I never realized
what it is, basically, Otis, is probably also it's part of a catch-22, because you got to be fair about this. One of the reasons they cut down on the number of writs is that it was greatly abused by people on death row. Because up until they limited the number of writs,
I was just going to say, Gloria?
Yeah.
You'll call us back, right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I don't know if perhaps there's not any family or friends of Chris Coleman, but nobody else has walked across the street.
So that's very unusual. I've never been here when there wasn't...
somebody.
At least one person, but usually there's a group for almost everybody. I don't know if he had a spiritual advisor or not. I know that tonight the organizers of the 10th Annual March to Abolish the Death Penalty are speaking with Todd Willingham's family and making arrangements for them to come to the march this year. They came to the, let's see, 2006 march, 3 years ago, after the Chicago Tribune had done a whole expose showing he was innocent. And I remember talking to his mom, and I'm from Oklahoma, and so is she, so we kind of talked a bit, and she was telling me how hard it was for her to live in this little town in Oklahoma where she could go to the grocery store and know everybody in the store, but nobody would speak to her. Or if they did, they'd say, how could you have raised a son who would murder his own children? So this woman has been, you know, when you, somebody's executed, it's not just the person executed and being executed, but, you know, being punished. It's the whole family.
Right.
So, I'm thinking of his mom and wondering how she feels today, knowing that he, when he was on the gurney and said, you're executing an innocent person, and nobody believed him, and now it looks like he was telling the truth. I wonder, I mean, it's... I don't know if there's any vindication. How can there be when you've lost your child, I guess?
Right.
But anyway. Okay, well, I'll call you back when I figure out what's happened.
Thanks, Gloria.
Okay.
Later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So you were saying, well, I know that this case and the Willingham case are totally different. For anyone who doesn't know, Todd Willingham was executed for... setting fire to his house and killing three children.
Two
children. And later investigation suggests that the arson that the prosecution presented, I think, did he use the word magical?
They said it was junk science. What happened? They had finally they found an expert who knew what he's talking about. It was a guy out of Austin, got a Cambridge degree in Cambridge in chemistry. And initially, the guy's kind of a strange sort of person. He was interested in explosives, and so he built a bunch of bombs and things for the government. And then he decided blowing up people wasn't a smart thing to do, and he got really interested in arson investigation. And he recreated a whole bunch of arson cases and became probably the leading expert in the state in arson. He went back and looked at all the... There were two arson people involved in the Willingham case. One was a state arson investigator, and one was a local one. And what they basically said, this was junk science, and a lot of what arson investigators rely upon are like old wives' tales. For example, when they try to claim that a fire started at one scene, he said, that's nonsense. That was a blowback from oxygen coming into the room that created the problem. And he claimed that there was absolutely no evidence that Todd Willingham set the fire, that it was probably electrical fire. In fact, one of the state arson investigators, this is just crazy, claims he'd investigated 1,000-something arson cases, and over 60% of them were arson, deliberately set. Now, that's nuts. I mean, no one's going to believe that. And he basically said what the arson people are doing, and that's junk science. But again, that has nothing to do with this case because no experts were involved in it, none whatsoever, and it wasn't an arson case.
So. Well, I assume this hinged on the eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, here's what happened, Otis.
The Christopher Coleman case.
We're talking Christopher Coleman, the one they're going to execute this evening. What happened is late one night on December the 13th or the early morning hours of December the 14th, a car pulled into a dead-end street. Inside of that car were four people, two males, a female, and her three-year-old baby. And they parked at the end of the dead-end street. Shortly after they parked there, a second car drives up. Inside the second car is Christopher Coleman. He's a passenger. A guy named Enrique Mosquera and a guy by the name of Derek Graham. All three of the men get out of the car, and according to Graham and according to one of the survivors in the car that was there first, Coleman goes over to the passenger side, and the other two people on the other side of the car, and they engage in a conversation with the driver, who's male. And then, sometime during that conversation, they say that Coleman opened fire on the car and shot everybody inside the car. The two adult males were both killed. The three-year-old baby was killed. And the only survivor was a woman named Elsie Prado. And it was her boyfriend that was driving, and it was her brother who was killed. So of Elsie Prado, her baby was killed, her brother was killed, and her boyfriend was killed. And she claimed that about what happened, they showed her a photographic spread, I think it was 9 days after the shooting took place, and she identified De Coleman as the shooter. And what she said at trial and what she said at the time, she'd never forget the face because he opened fire on inside the car. And she identified him at the trial as being the shooter. He was arrested 2 weeks later in Tennessee. And the Houston Police Department go out and talk to Coleman, and he gives a written confession admitting being at the scene of the shooting, but denied being the shooter, but he admitted being there. And then when they interviewed Graham, one of the co-defendants, when the police initially interviewed Graham, they knew the shooter was on the passenger side of the car, and Graham said that he and Enrique, the other Gilman, were on the driver's side, and Coleman was the only one on the passenger side. So there was Graham's comments, plus they had the eyeball identification of Elsie Prado, plus you have the confession that Coleman gave, admitted being at the scene but denying being the shooter. That was basically the case. Now, where the issue came down, when Prado testified at trial, she initially claimed that it was like a random shooting, that she didn't know anybody involved. And she just claimed it was a random, I guess someone going to decide to shoot somebody in a parked car. And she just denied knowing any of the people involved in the shooting. Now, in the latest writ that the defense lawyers have filed, what they claim, and I don't know where this comes from the writ because the court opinions never indicate this. One of the lawyers filing the latest federal writ claimed that an investigator talked to Elsie Prado, and she admitted knowing the guy named Enrique Mosquera, that they both were from the same town in Columbia, and she admitted knowing him. And then they got a statement from Enrique Mosquera, who's now serving a life sentence. And what he said in his affidavit, they do have an affidavit from him, but they do not have an affidavit apparently from Prado. And in his affidavit, what he basically said was that he knew Elsie Prado, that what had happened, he owed Elsie Prado's boyfriend a bunch of money, and that this was a drug deal. And he claimed that what he had done, he owed like something like $80,000 to Prado's boyfriend. So he gets this other two, Derek Graham and Coleman, his muscle, and they're going to go over there and rob the boyfriend to satisfy the $80,000 debt. They were going to get rid of that debt. And he took the other two as muscle. He claimed they knew each other and it wasn't a random shooting. Now, what the lawyers are claiming, had this evidence been brought out in front of the jury, it might have made a major difference about him getting the death penalty. And they said this information was not available to the defense lawyers. A guy named Dick Whelan, another guy, defended Coleman at trial. And had this been available, they would attack the credibility of Elsie Prado. But a couple of things that are interesting about that is, number one, when they got the affidavit from the co-defendant, he never said Coleman was not the shooter. Ever said that. The next thing that happened, the other defendant puts Coleman on the side where the shooting occurred. And so the theory, the defensive theory on this latest writ was that she was lying about knowing Enrique Esquerra because they were both from Columbia, the same village. He's worried about his family retaliating against her family in Columbia and therefore didn't finger him as the shooter. But that's all pure speculation because no one's ever said, in any of the parties involved, that Coleman was not the shooter other than Coleman.
Yeah, and you wonder in something like this, you know, in reading it, it's pretty bare. And then Coleman started shooting.
See, the thing,
what would start that off?
Here's what doesn't make sense to me, Otis. And there's several weird things about this case that there are really some unanswered questions. Number one, I've been involved in a lot of trials involving drug transactions. I've never heard of people doing a drug deal, taking their girlfriend and three-year-old baby late at night to do a drug transaction, because everybody knows when you're carrying drugs and a lot of money, there's a very good likelihood they're going to try to get robbed and someone's going to get shot. And I've never known of a drug dealer who would take his girlfriend and her three-year-old baby to a scene to do a drug transaction with a lot of money involved. And that doesn't make any sense to me. That doesn't have a ring of truth to it.
How about, putting the, civilians in the middle of where the army is? I mean,
that's a war. I'm talking about drug.
I'm saying, would somebody have thought, for instance, geez, if I bring the wife and the kid, then they'll just think we're out for a ride?
This was late at night. I don't think. Okay. I just never heard of it before. And the next thing that really
bothers it seems weird.
Nothing really bothers me about this case. Coleman doesn't have any record of being a real violent person. He's never been to the penitentiary. He went to serve 60 days in the Harris County Jail for an assault, which means that was a misdemeanor assault. And a misdemeanor assault means you touch somebody offensively. It could be anything from a fight to a slap. And that's it. That's his whole criminal record. Although they did introduce evidence at punishment about... No, they didn't either. Just all they introduced was that one particular case. And that doesn't have a ring of truth to it that... Somebody who is not normally hadn't been violent in times past that would just pull out a gun, shoot into the car, and kill four people. Now, I couldn't, what happened when I was trying to research this case, I couldn't pull down the opinion of the Court of Criminal Appeals that went up on direct appeal because it's unpublished and it's so old I couldn't find it. But they did have what's called a Penry issue. And what they're talking about, if there's evidence of a real sad childhood, and what the Penry issue asks the jury this, taking into due consideration the circumstances of somebody's life, a deprived childhood, is this a person that should deserve a life sentence because of his background as opposed to the death sentence? And that was the issue the jury got hung up on initially when they first tried the case. So I'm assuming that during the trial there was a lot of evidence about Coleman being raised in terrible circumstances, and you would have gotten what we call the mitigation Penry issue. Because basically when you develop that issue of punishment, you go into a person's background, and usually it's the same thing you hear over and over again, come a broken home, alcoholic parents, getting beat up as a child, and the horrible things that happen to children. And I'm assuming a lot of this evidence came out during the trial, because what's real interesting about this case is they submitted a Penry issue, which meant that sort of evidence came in. And one of the issues they brought up in their post-conviction writs was, the jury answered the first two, because see, the jury doesn't vote kill him. They don't say that. What they do, they answer a series of questions called special issues. The first issue, was it deliberate? Second issue, is he a future danger to public? That's the first two major issues. And then if the evidence raises it, they do the mitigation issue. The jury was hung up on the mitigation issue and said they were hung. And they sent a note out to the judge and said they'd been deliberating all morning and sent a note that afternoon saying we're hung up on issue number three.
Okay, now this is the punishment phase.
Yes.
I'm not talking about guilt and innocence.
Yes. It's the punishment phase. And so what happened when they said they were hung up, the judge brought them out and said, don't tell me how you're voting, but you give me the numerical numbers. And they said it was 8-4. And the four that are not agreeing with us are not likely to change their mind. He says, well, I'm going to take you to lunch and come back and do some more deliberating. They came back from lunch, deliberated some more, and they said they were hopelessly deadlocked, and they were now at 10-2. And so at that time, he sends them instructions to continue deliberations. And so finally, they answered special issue, the mitigation issue, that he didn't deserve a life sentence. So I'm assuming there was a good deal of evidence at the trial level about his tragic background, which could I suppose, but usually when somebody comes to that background, you're going to find a juvenile record. They're going to be now the juvenile reform schools. You're going to find a psychiatrist testifying that he's sociopathic and antisocial. You're going to find instances, because we all, and it's typically true in people of that background, that the juvenile system is simply a training ground to go to prison. Now, he's got prison convictions. And this guy has none of those things. Although, obviously, he had a tragic childhood. They wouldn't have gotten the Penry issue, this mitigation issue submitted. But the two things that bother me, the drug, taking the child and girlfriend to a... And we're talking about $80,000. That's a lot of money involved. And you just, that just unheard of.
Who owed the money to whom?
What happened is that a guy named Ricky Mascara
okay.
owed the money to Prada's boyfriend.
That's what I thought. Okay.
And he hires Coleman and the other guy to go as muscle in case there's a problem.
So, but they're just trying to get out of the 80.
Yeah.
The 80,000.
They're going to rob him. Right. I'm sure they set up a deal to rob him, and then they're going to pay the 80,000. I guess they're going to rob him and pay some kind of a, it's a kind of a crazy idea to rob a guy to satisfy a debt. That doesn't make a lot of sense either.
What did we know about the two guys who got
couldn't
life?
Find anything about their priors. They both got life sentences. And what happened, the writ lawyers later got an affidavit, as I mentioned earlier, from Enrique Espreja. I guess it's called Mosquera. They got an affidavit from him claiming that he knew the survivor and they knew each other. And she wasn't telling the truth at trial because she denied knowing anybody at trial. And they got an affidavit from him, but the opinion said nothing about their prior backgrounds. But you can, one of them, first of all, this, they were most of them from Colombia. Enrique Mosquera was from Colombia. The people, in, a lot of the people in the car were from Colombia. They were Colombians, and then the other two, of course, Coleman and Derek Graham, were not from Colombians. They were just guys that went along for muscle. And I, like I say, I just can't imagine. It just seems odd that even if it was a drug deal, it just seems odd to me that Coleman, something like, he wouldn't, he was there, you know, as a, like a stand-in, that he would kind of twist off and start opening fire and shoot four people inside of a car. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but somebody obviously did it, and she identified him as being the shooter.
Well, it makes you, I mean, I know of cases where at least the guys claimed that they were in the car when the guy was in there killing his father, basically. That was one of them. I think it was Carl Kinnaman. Where they end up getting the death penalty because the guy, the shooter turns.
Well, that's maybe, that's kind of a rare instance. It could be true, but somewhat rare.
And I just wonder how you pick, I mean, they think of Brandley. We know why they picked Brandley, because the Ranger said it. But there seems to be an element of, I've decided, you know, within the investigation and the prosecution, we decide that's the guy. And then all the facts and any other information that comes in, we, you know, basically do what humans do, is ignore data if it doesn't match your belief.
It's interesting you mention that. I just finished a book on a famous case in England. Mm-hmm. Where a lawyer was poisoned to death, and they want to know who did it. And one of the things he mentioned that's bad to do in any type of investigation is to draw conclusions initially. Because then you, what you tend to do is look for things that back up your conclusions rather than looking at the data.
And you tend to ignore what doesn't.
Right. Yeah. And like I say, there's, even if he's not the shooter, he admitted being there, admitted helping Enrique Escadra collect his money. So he could be held guilty of capital murder under the law of parties because he was there assisting. And they could possibly, they're not, Texas has not been real bad about putting non-trigger man in the penitentiary, I mean, in the death row. I remember a case out of Florida where the trigger man, the guy that did the actual killing, got a sentence in jail, and the person that didn't do the killing who helped him got the death sentence. And the time the death sentence was carried out, the guy who actually did the killing had paroled out. But that's, you know, that was back in Florida, had Texas's reputation, and we've taken over Florida. But that's the only case I can think of. At least.
But you wonder, you know, why that happens, because, you know, theoretically we're looking for justice and all this other stuff. And
well, see, one of the problems we've complained about a great deal, a lot of it is all within the discretion of a prosecutor. And if you got a prosecution office, and I complained about our office here during the reign of Johnny, because Johnny Holmes was a prosecutor during this, and during this period of time. And Johnny should have been the sheriff rather than a lawyer, because he was really more of a cop than he was a lawyer. And what happened, I worked in the DA's office under Carol Vance. In fact, I worked with Johnny. And back then, we kind of had the same theory that we held for defense lawyers, to keep arm's length from your client, which meant we didn't associate with the police because they were trying to be objective about it. What happened when Johnny joined the police department, there was a marriage between the police department the DA's office, and the tail began to wag the dog. And so, say you have a jurisdiction like that where they seek the death penalty on a lot of cases that other jurisdictions wouldn't. And so we've argued for a long time there should be some type of statewide policy rather than giving... See, the sole discretion to seek the death penalty rests solely with the local prosecutor. That's it. There's no guidelines. If he wants to seek the death penalty, he can do it. And there's not a thing you can do to stop it. And so a lot of it depends upon what jurisdiction you're in and on their sense of fairness. And so, like I say, that it's a real serious... We've argued about that, but they have been... The courts have been real reluctant to step on what they call the sovereignty of the state, upon the discretion of the state and state prosecutor. And so it depends on who your elected prosecutor is. If you get some rabid law and order person, you're going to have a lot of crazy death penalty cases.
Well, isn't the... Now, from the point of view, we elect our district attorney.
Right.
Which means they have to run for office. And most of them run on the basis of, I'm going to be tougher on crime than anybody else, anybody before me, or, you know, tougher on crime. I don't think anybody's ever campaigned, not even a Democrat, for being soft on crime. So they have to show that they're tough on crime, don't they?
Yes.
And isn't the conviction rate, I mean, if you make a case capital, isn't the conviction rate better?
Conviction rate. You know, it's kind
because
of...
Because you can threaten. I mean, you can say, this guy deserves the death penalty, you know.
Let me tell you what they're doing now, what the new trend is now. And I don't... And the death penalty people aren't alarmed by it, but I am. What they're doing now is seeking the death... Finally, it's a capital murder, but waiving the death penalty. Do we have a call coming in?
Yeah, I think so.
We have Gloria Rubick online.
And that's... Gloria.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah. So?
Well, the execution has taken place, and there were no witnesses for the man being executed.
Wow.
And, you know, I was visiting on... I just realized I was visiting on death row last week, and he did have family visiting him. But, you know, some guys tell their family they don't want to put him first, but it's very rare that they don't have friends or a spiritual advisor or somebody...
Yeah.
To be there with them. So this is a very unusual execution. In fact, those of us who are standing out here, we're talking about it, and Dennis Longmire, the professor at St. Houston, said, gee, you know, I would be happy to be with somebody.
Yeah.
To witness the execution so they wouldn't have to be there alone. I said, well, you know what, I think I'm going to put that in our newsletter. And, you know, it doesn't happen. I have never seen it. I don't ever remember this. Dennis said he remembers a couple of times it's happened. So anyway, he said, yeah, you can tell them to write me if they have absolutely nobody to be with them when they're executed.
Very strange. So, very strange. And Jim, we were talking about the case, and it's a strange case. There is a certain strangeness to this case.
On both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. And this just adds to it. What are we going to find out? Is there going to be a New Yorker article
years? Here we did a case not long ago on Execution Watch, and there were no witnesses because that guy killed all of his family. And I guess there's no one there to witness it, see? So.
Yeah, all right, Gloria. Anything else?
Well,
we found out. When is the march this year?
The march is on Saturday, October 24th in Austin this year, not Houston, at 2 o'clock at the Capitol.
Okay.
So,
and all of the coalitions will be there.
Lots of people will be there, and I'm so glad that it looks like the Willingham family will be there. And I'm going to actually drive up to the Texas Forensic Science Commission's meeting next week and talk to the guy. I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's Beyler, who did the report.
Right.
And invite him to come. I doubt that he will, but...
Well, you never know.
You never know till you ask. And he's going to actually be there because they're going to be asking him questions about his report.
Yeah,
some of us are going to speak because they're going to have a public comment section also.
Yeah, this information will be on the... It'll be on the Execution Watch site. executionwatch.org, and also we have links there to Coalition Against the Death Penalty and the other organizations, so
we'll
all know about this and maybe show up at the state capitol.
Great.
Thanks, Gloria.
Yeah, and we've got a bus leaving from Shape Center that in at 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay, that morning.
Yeah.
Cool, okay. All right, all that'll be, we'll be showing up.
That's good.
Thanks, Gloria.
All right, thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, one more example of righteousness.
One thing I failed to mention.
I want to say this is Execution Watch. I'm not Ray Hill. I'm Otis McClay, and I'm sitting in for Ray. And I'm here with Jim Skelton, and later we'll be talking with Dave Atwood.
One thing, another thing is unusual about this case, he got some real good lawyering. A guy named Dick Whelan was his initial trial lawyer. Dick died of cancer here about a year ago. Dick was a very fine lawyer and did a lot of preparation, was real diligent. You have to get a call?
I guess Dave Atwood's on.
Okay.
So let me see if I can do this. Dave.
Hello?
Hello? Why don't I hear anything? Oh, because I got the wrong thing. There we go. Hi.
Hi there.
This is Otis. Ray's away. And we're talking now with Dave Atwood, who is the... Are you the chair now?
No, I guess you could say the founder of the Texas Coalition.
Against the death penalty, right.
Right, right.
And where are you now?
We're out at the corner of Alabama... by St. Stephen's Church, corner of Alabama and Woodhead. St. Stephen's Episcopal Church is right there.
And are we seeing many people?
Well, we get a lot of people come by. I mean, we pick the corners where we stand in Houston, you know, based on the amount of traffic flow. So we really... have an awful lot of cars go by. There were about, I guess, 7 or 8 of us out there today, which was not too bad considering the weather, but we have, you know, hundreds of cars go by, so it's a good visibility spot.
Anybody honk?
And one of the interesting things is that, now, I've been out there on these street corners and up in Huntsville for many years, and you really see a change in the response. I mean, majority of the people, if they respond, give us a thumbs up. And it used to be just the opposite. We used to get thumbs down. We call it our street corner polling, and good. It works well, you know, and I think it's important that there is visibility in the city, in addition to being up in Huntsville, both places. But people can tell that there are people out there that are against the death penalty.
Well, I'm waiting for a DA to run against the death penalty.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
I mean, suggest that maybe the death penalty makes you less safe.
Yeah,
crime after, what was it, after the, not McGregor, is that the one I mean? When the death penalty stopped. When it was stopped.
Furman versus Georgia.
Yeah. As the states started reinstituting the death penalty, their rate of violent crime went up. Every state that reinstituted it, the violent crime went up. I wonder if anybody would be willing to mention that, you know, when they're running for office.
You think about how we use our resources, this whole death penalty process being so expensive, and thinking about how those resources could be used to prevent crime. I mean, it's a false solution to the crime problem is to think that the death penalty is going to have anything to do with it. And like you say, you know, drives it the other direction. A lot of people don't know this. That's why we try to do as much as we can on education on some of these facts, that people just don't understand how this whole system works and how bad the death penalty is for the state of Texas, for every common everyday citizens. We have a, you know, we've been educating for a long time too, and we'll go out to schools, churches, universities, civic clubs, wherever anybody will hear us, and give them information on the death penalty, and that it does help. A lot of people just don't have information. They're sort of ignorant on the subject.
Well, it's never. It's
the way, you know, what we're doing, even standing out on the street corner, our signs are all, we try to make them educational and, you know, try to show people that this is not good for anybody.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Doesn't work. And,
but it's interesting, you know, I like to look at the what is the human thing that drives this need to kill people? I mean, is it that the state wants to assert its ultimate authority? It has the authority of death, but unfortunately the state cannot give life. It is not God yet.
Yeah, I think there are a number of factors go into it. For a lot of people, like I say, your common everyday citizens, I think it's pure ignorance. They just don't know. They have been told a lot of lies over the years. Then you have a certain element of your population that truly believe in an eye for an eye kind of justice. That's just their sense of justice. They may have grown up with it. It gets reinforced in lots of ways in movies, television. I mean, any number of ways an eye for an eye mentality gets reinforced. And
well, the eye for an eye, of course, that's a great thing. That the eye for an eye statement in the Bible was meant to limit punishment,
right?
Because
right.
that was, you know, previous to that, everything was death,
right?
You know, it was death for looking at your neighbor's wife, and the eye for an eye was to limit punishment, not to create it.
I know, and but a lot of people don't understand that. In fact, probably most people don't understand what you just said then. But that's what the whole thing was about. And
of course, the Bible has plenty of, I mean, there are things in the Bible that said, you know, I mean, yes, Leviticus says you stone everybody to death and so forth. And then there's stuff in the Bible that says God is the judge. So,
yeah.
So the Bible, I guess you can pick whatever you need to make your point.
You can certainly do that with the Bible. That's for sure. I basically myself, if I'm talking with anybody on that, from that perspective, I talk to them. I say, well, don't forget the New Testament and some of the teachings in there are quite contradictory to revenge of any sort. They're talking about compassion, forgiveness, mercy, and so, you know, where are you in this whole Bible discussion? Are you the Old Testament, New Testament, or what? But people can pick out whatever they want, and they certainly do it. It's interesting. Most of the major Christian denominations have official statements against the death penalty now. The only one that doesn't, that actually supports the death penalty officially, are the Southern Baptists. But if you talk with people who support that position, they will primarily be talking Old Testament, and they don't refer to the New Testament very much. And I think when they do refer to the New Testament, in my way of thinking, it's not a correct interpretation of what they're saying. But you know, even beyond everything to do with religion and the Bible, we've got a criminal justice system that, my way of thinking, is so broken in so many different ways and so unreliable that to have this ultimate punishment possible when, and I don't think we're ever going to be able to fix the system to the point where you could say you're never going to make a mistake. Certainly there could be improvements, but boy, when you know, looking at these cases over many, many years, and you realize that you have a human system, if you want to describe it that way, and it's capable of error. A lot of, you know, people have biases in different ways, and it's just there, and to have this ultimate punishment as a possibility when you've got this human legal system that we have, which, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's a pretty good system, and in many ways maybe it is, but, of course, a lot of us know that it's, you know, how much money you have has a lot to do with what happens there, how good a legal defense you can get. But it's just the possibility of making a mistake is enough. Should be enough reason for anybody, I would think, to say, you know, we can do something else other than the death penalty, and still be tough on crime. I mean, we can have long prison sentences if that's what's needed.
That's a whole other.
If we want to be tough on crime, we can use that money that's wasted on the death penalty and get into some real crime prevention programs.
Or, you know, schools, things like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dave, you'll be in Austin, I guess. Well, Thursday, I guess we have another one of these.
Yeah, another one on Thursday, unfortunately, yep. Oh.
And that's a whole other story. Anyway, thank you for being there.
Okay,
and
well.
What you do, and we'll talk to you Thursday, I guess.
All righty.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's Dave Atwood. Dave has been active in the death penalty, anti-death penalty movement for more than 15 years, and he's done about all of it. The Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, TCADP.org, I think that's what it is. And also those links are on the Execution Watch site. There's a little thing there that says links, and if you click it there, we had about 20 links up there. Because it's very funny what I'm seeing, that there are all of these sort of disparate groups, and somehow there's no groundswell to end this. If we ended the death penalty, we would have lots and lots of money, probably to apply to much more useful things. And I am personally a total radical, because I don't believe in punishment. I don't think punishment works. Natural consequences, but not punishment. Anyway, that's a whole other issue. My name's Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill, who is away this week, and I'm here with Jim Skelton. And we're talking about this Christopher Coleman case and the strangeness. You know, the problem that I have with our approach to crime with the legal system is that the whole business of the legal system is not really about finding out what happened. It's about who's going to win the trial. Want to say something to that, Jim?
Well, let me mention one thing I was starting to say earlier.
Yeah.
Another unusual aspect about this case, he got some very, very good lawyering.
Yeah.
I don't know who did the direct appeal, but back when he did his direct appeal, the way it normally works, you get a lawyer appointed at the trial level. And Dick Whelan's a fine lawyer. And then they have another lawyer appointed on appeal. And then back in his days, it's changed some. If you wanted to do a post-conviction writ, you're on your own. They didn't appoint a lawyer for you. The Court of Criminal Appeals didn't appoint one, and the state court didn't. Now, somebody, a group of lawyers, I don't know who they were, they filed four state writs at their own expense and on their own dime. And then they filed a federal writ. And then they filed a writ in the Fifth, and they appealed the ruling in the Fifth Circuit and went up to the Supreme Court and a certiorari. And I know Pat McCann worked on it later, and Pat has filed a, filed a writ of prohibition in the Court of Criminal Appeals, sought permission to file another writ, and they hired an investigator. All the lawyers paid for this out of their own pocket. So, and this is not one of those cases. It's unusual in the sense that they normally don't have four or five successive writs filed, and there's no provision to pay for that. Lawyers did this all on their own because they felt like there's some type of injustice being done. And I think that, you know, he certainly got good lawyering. Pat's a fine, fine lawyer, and he's been the one representing him toward the end. I don't know if Pat did the earlier writs or not, but nobody can complain that this is one of those cases where the lawyer laid down on the job. And the thing is, Otis, and I've talked about this a lot, men by nature are fairly competitive, regardless of how liberal you claim you are, conservative, all of us are fairly competitive. And what happens, the legal system takes that trait and exacerbates it. And I don't know how you would go about it. Here's one thing I think that would make our system much fairer. Because years ago, I mean, I'm pretty much of a pagan. And I think where Christianity went astray is when they made a profession out of preachers, because then preachers had to depend upon the congregation to make a living. Therefore, they couldn't be leaders anymore. They had to, you know, kiss ass to get paid. Because I've often said that a Methodist was a Baptist that learned to read. A Presbyterian was a Methodist that moved to town. The Episcopalian was a Presbyterian that got rich. And that's about my summation of Christianity.
But I'm not rich.
But in the same thing. And what happens, here's what I think we should be able to do. We should have a criminal bar association, period. And in some cases, I should be a judge. We shouldn't have professional prosecutors, and we shouldn't have professional judges. And in some cases, I'd be assigned by an administrator to be a judge on some cases, a prosecutor on some, and a defense lawyer on some. Because what happens, you get kind of welded. Your brain kind of, it's like having a wagon with a long spoke. You lose your perspective. And see, one of the major problems we got here
this
in Arizona.
This is the kind of thing that happens to some cops where everybody they talk to is guilty.
If so, of course, because they get the feeling that way.
Yeah.
And you can get more balance in the system, because if we had a system where you don't have professional prosecutors, you don't have professional judges. Because see, here's one of the major problems we've got in state, and one of the major problems in Harris County. The lawyers who can't make a living keep running for judge, they get elected. Or they've been in the DA's office and get appointed. And they've never defended a person in their life. They're a prosecutor one day and they're sitting on the bench the next. And they know absolutely nothing about defending people. And you're much better off if you've had a balance. You've had some balance of being a defense lawyer. Because a lot of your ideas that you get are twisted simply because of your perspective. And the way to really balance, and what happens, a lawyer who can't make a living and runs, and finally, it's funny, as a judge once said, you better show some respect for me. I had to kiss a lot of ass to get up here. Well, and so what happens, those judges are not going to take a chance and rule unfavorably. They're going to go with the crowd. They're like that part in the Bible that talks about the wheat chaff going where the wind blows it. That's exactly what they're going to do. So if you have a judge who has independence, you can't fire him because he makes a decision, but he's not there for life. So what I think I would like to see done is have a criminal bar association. You have to pass a test in criminal law to be a member of it. Then when you become a member of it, when a case comes up, you'll have an administrative staff that will process it, but you'll be assigned to prosecutor on some cases, you'll be assigned as a defense lawyer on some cases, and a judge in other cases.
That's brilliant.
Because then you can get a perspective of how the system works.
Yeah.
If you're you see both sides, and you're more balanced that way. Now, that would make a fair system.
And you
system.
Also don't have, a prosecutor is looking at his election. I thought that they were supposed to prosecute the law and not the defendant.
You know, I think that's probably over-exaggerated.
Yeah.
I think what happens is the prosecutor starts getting the mentality of a policeman that all people are bad. And I think another thing, they have a bad habit.
Yeah, as a result of what they're doing.
What they're doing, because they read bad stuff all day long.
Yeah.
They don't read about good people. They read about bad people. And another thing that it's always annoyed me, a lot of the prosecutors come from upper-middle-class families, and here's what's happened to them. They've never had to work. Their parents paid their way through school. They paid their way through law school. They get out and get a job with the government, and they've never had to really work and grovel, and they don't know what it's like to be tempted for being a 15-year-old kid to be hungry and steal something. They can't relate to that feeling. They've never been there before. And I just think if we had a system like I've described, I think we'd eliminate a whole bunch of these problems. If you would just kind of rotate what these people are doing. Because some of our judges here are absolutely pathetic. I've often teased, and there's a lot of truth to it, that our judiciary's retirement program for the DA's office. And I've often said...
Yeah, we have Pat Likos now, who's going the other way.
Well... That's another story.
Okay.
And I've often said it doesn't take a whole lot of... In fact, I was a prosecutor, and it doesn't take a great deal of skill to be a prosecutor, truthfully. As a matter of fact, the worst thing I disliked about it was boring, because it's too easy. Because, number one, most of your cops are professional witnesses. Most of the jurors are sympathetic to your viewpoint. And I've often said, to be a good prosecutor, you have to know two things. What's your name? And the next one is what happened next. And with those two phrases, you can try almost any case on the earth. And if you get real senile, you become a judge. And all you have to do then is say two words, sustained or overruled. If you can keep those two phrases down, you can be a great judge. You just got to stay awake half the time.
You just flip a coin to find out whether it's sustained or overruled.
Or like the judge looked at a watch and it said 10:30, and they've got 10.5 years. So it's one of those things.
Okay, we have, do you want to do it? We have with us,
Andre?
Yeah.
Hi.
Okay, we have with us, I've got to find his name, Andre Bias.
Yeah.
Andre's the older brother of death row inmate Reginald Blanton, who is
supposed to be executed October 27th. And, Andre, I think one of the things is, what is it like to have, you know, a relative, someone you're close to on death row? What's it been like for you?
It's very difficult. Over the past few years, you know, I have been in disbelief of what has been transpiring. And as the days get closer and closer, you know, and watching my whole family going through this transition, it really hurts that, you know, not only that, being there, listening to the cases, read the case files, and knowing that, you know, he was discriminated against and that there was a lot of violations that was brought upon him, it hurts that to know that Texas is going to still allow the death penalty to go forward.
Is this discrimination because he's black?
Well, not just because he's black.
Well, class.
The discrimination is that since he didn't know the legal system and how to fight against the legal system, they just took it upon themselves to, hey, you know, he was there. He was at the scene of the crime. He was the one that did it, and that was it. You know, they didn't have any evidence, physical evidence, to link him to the crime. You know, it was just that he was a troubled child from before. You know, he was in and out of juvenile facility, so he was capable of committing this crime.
Oh, so because he could have done it, he must have done it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is what, Jim, this is what you and I were talking about.
Right.
Exactly, that you get, I mean, this is a characteristic of humans, is that if the data disagrees with what we believe, we're going to favor what we believe. That's a human thing. That's just how we're wired up.
Yeah.
So the only way to deal with it is to be conscious of it and, you know, and not do it.
Exactly.
But it feels good to be right. How do you get treated when you go up there?
Well, I haven't been able to go up there.
No?
He had just now put me on the list because it took a while to get me on the list.
Ah, okay.
And
yeah, people don't know you have to be on the list.
Before that day, I've been working with a lot of coalitions to try to abolish the death penalty here in the state of Texas because, you know, one too many have been killed that have been found innocent later.
Yeah, we just
so
big splash on that one, Todd.
You know, I've been working very hard on this, and I've been keeping in contact with letters to Reg, you know, to let him know to keep his head up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not through, and I will never be through until somebody do away with the death penalty here in the state of Texas.
Do you have a website, Andre, or anything like that?
I don't have a website. Reginald has a website, and his girlfriend has been keeping up with the website. She just, you know, she'll shoot to me whatever is going on. She'll shoot me an email, and then I'll respond that way.
Okay. All right, what do you want to leave us with? What would you like to say to the people who are listening to this?
To the people, I want to say, you know your rights. Educate yourself with Texas law. I don't know if people out there know that Texas changes their law at least every 3 months to 6 months, because if somebody wants to find a loophole, you know, and Texas was at fault, then they try to correct that loophole where they won't be at fault anymore. And two, you know, fight and continue fighting. Don't be discouraged by people that supposedly have degrees, because they also make mistakes as well.
That's for sure. Speaking as someone who doesn't have a degree, I could say that. Well, Andre, we'll probably talk to you again. And we'll be here, you know, on the 27th, hopefully. Hopefully we won't be here.
Yeah,
that would be the best
thing. That is my goal. I'm hoping that we won't ever reach that date.
And somebody's working on the case?
Well, some of the attorneys that we had before, I guess they decided, well, we have a lot of heat on them and a lot of publicity that's been coming out of this. So they're trying their best to try to get this overturned and get a stay of execution. And that's what our main goal is, so it can give us more time to work and submit evidence that we couldn't submit evidence before.
Okay.
You know, I've been doing a lot of research on the judge that convicted my brother, and she hasn't been long of a judge, to a criminal justice judge, to do trials like this. She's only been in for at least 9 years, and then she was the one that was, she just got into office at the time my brother was sentenced to death row.
Hmm.
So,
all right, well, this
being upon her, and George Bush was the one that appointed her as the judge for this criminal court.
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, Andre. Thank you for calling in. Thank you for letting us know what's going on. And
sure will.
I guess my heart goes out to you, and I think everybody else's does too. And, you know, give our love to your brother.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Andre Bias, the brother of Reginald Blanton, who is scheduled to die October 27th. And we'll see. Apparently, I don't know the case. Apparently, there's a lot of stuff about this case. Apparently, it's pretty, you know, circumstantial, maybe, sort of, kind of. Jim? Rescue me.
Don't know anything about him.
Yeah, well, we will know more then. I think your idea of the, I mean, to take the competition out of this whole process, because the competition really obscures the story. It seems to me the thing you'd really want to find out is the story. What happened?
Well, it wouldn't take the competition out. It just makes it more balanced. You have the people competing, knowing all sides of the story. And I just think it would make a fairer system. That's all I'm saying. It'd make it better than what we've got now. It's not a question. You've got to figure out a system. You know, liberals are real good, and I'm one of them, about bitching about things, but they don't have usually good solutions.
Well, we tend to think that legislation will solve it.
Man will solve anything.
No.
You can't change the basic nature of man.
No.
And so what you've got to do is make the system better than it was before. And I think that by my idea of rotating and not having a professional judiciary or professional prosecutor.
Are people interested in this? I mean, is this... Have you put this out there so that there are people who are thinking about it?
Talk to you and Dan. That's about it. That's your my audience.
Well, we need to go out and push this. You know, it would save money. It would get rid of this. I mean, I'm so in the middle about how do we get judges? Do we want to appoint them? Do we want to elect them? You know, electing doesn't work. What?
I want to eliminate them. I don't want a professional
judge. Do it this way, where Caucasian Chalk Circle has Dak, who says you want decent, or Robert Heinlein and the Moon is a harsh mistress. You want a decent judge here. You know, pay me, and I'll be a good judge. I need to get paid. I think we're done for today. I think I've got to kind of wrap it up, because Marlo Blue, who is sitting in today for what? Yeah, right, cracking the whip for Elizabeth Stein, who is on flu assignment. Yeah, and she's talking like this. So Marlo is running the show today. And she gave me something to read. Thanks to Gloria Ruback, Dave Atwood, Elizabeth Stein, Marlo Blue, I said that, and Andre Bias for calling in. He did that totally on his own, which I think is really kind of great. And this is tough stuff to talk about. And, of course, I want to thank Jim Skelton, who is the one here who has interesting things to say. I think this is fascinating stuff, how we operate. How do we operate our lives? And is this system working? Gosh, you know, my theory is if punishment worked, we wouldn't have any crime, because we sure have a lot of punishment. We could talk about that. The hot thing right now is the guys who escaped from Alcatraz. That's what everybody's talking about. Unfortunately, we will probably be here this Thursday when Kenneth Mosley is scheduled to die at the hands of the state.
and we will be here with the crew. Ray will be back next week. No, he will be back, I guess, in October. Is that the next one? Thank you.
You'll be here Thursday, Otis.
And I thank Dan Lundgren for being here, too. Did I get
Runson?
Runstrom, yeah.
I always forget. I'm so sorry. Dan has been part of the prison show for longer than I remember. And I started in, what, 85? Anyway, this is Otis McClay sitting in for Ray. Thanks to Jim, to Gloria Ruback. Marlo Blue made this thing happen. We will unfortunately see you Thursday unless we luck out and get a stay. This is KPFT Houston.